the narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host for the LBL Lost Halls podcast. I'm joined now by Adam Camilleri.
The sofa hand himself, Adam Camilleri.
And Red Powell.
What's up, everybody?
Adam, you've rejected every nickname I've given to you. Maybe this one will stick.
I'm unnameable just because it's too in flux. I used to be called the Salt Bay at the end of 7th edition because the end of 7th edition was such a crazy game. Either I was salty or my opponent was salty most games. So yeah, I was either the Salt Caller or the Salt Feeler.
In this episode, Red and I are going to chat with Mr. Dan Abnett.
Huge. That is so freaking cool, man.
How neat. In future episodes, coming up in the next couple of weeks, we're going to have a segment with Duncan Rhodes.
That's awesome.
Firing on all cylinders, Mr. Murphy. That is incredible, too.
You got more stuff planned. I mean, like, share, and subscribe if you have not already. And also, let me give a thanks to everyone who's left some reviews. The 5-star reviews, it means a whole lot. We take that stuff to heart, and we really appreciate seeing it. And the comments on YouTube, it really helps keep us going. Thank you very much for everyone who's done that and takes part in that discussion. Before we jump into the conversation, let's just take a break. We'll do that segment with Mr. Abnett, and then we'll come back and talk some 40K stuff. See you in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, welcome to a very special segment of Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined this afternoon by Red Powell.
Hello.
And the legendary Dan Abnett.
Hello.
Dan, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, absolute pleasure. Thank you for asking me on.
Oh, man. Well, it's our pleasure. So people may know you from writing Horus Heresy and Warhammer 40,000 novels. Man, I'm not even sure where to start.
Well, there's quite a list, certainly. Yes, I agree. I'm nothing if not prolific.
Well, it's been great stuff. One of the things I just want to mention is that, you know, I first became aware of you through Warhammer 40,000 stuff, but then quickly realized while I'm reading you that I became a fan of yours and have been really excited to see you pop up in things like Marvel Comics that I definitely want to talk about over the course of this show.
I'm a writer. Full stop. I do all sorts of different things, and I always have done, really. In fact, although the work for Games Workshop, which I love doing, and is a very important part of what I do, although that seems to be a mainstay of my work for over two decades, I was already a freelance writer when that came along. I was a comic book writer, had worked for Marvel and DC by then, so there was there's all sorts of different strands, and in the course of a day I'll wear different hats. You know, I'll sort of write a chapter of a novel and then I'll stop and I'll go and write something for 2000 AD or for DC or whatever, and move between those things. So yes, I'm a comic book writer, I'm a novelist, and I'm occasionally a game writer too. It's interesting you say that, because over the years I have discovered this odd phenomenon whereby I will encounter readers of a particular thing like Warhammer or Marvel or whatever, and they'll talk to me enthusiastically about the thing that they know me from for that thing, and then they'll say, isn't it weird, there's another guy with the same name who does the stuff over there for that other thing. I say, actually no, that's all me still.
What a coincidence.
Yes, it's quite an unusual name. It is all me doing all these different things. And for a long time, a stretch of probably 10-15 years, people thought there were more than one Dan Abnett, one who worked for comics and one who was this, that, and the other, you know. And gradually, the kind of demarcation between kind of franchises, I suppose, slowly began to melt. And nowadays, I get people, which is delightful, and I'm very, very appreciative of it, but I get people who come along and say, you know, I know you from X, but actually, I now read you in all sorts of other places. And you know, so Warhammer fans who've gone on to read American superhero comics, or Marvel or DC fans who now read Warhammer, or 2000 AD fans who are, et cetera, et cetera. You know what I mean? It's the crossover is happening more and more. And it's quite fun to sort of draw readers who are very familiar with one universe into another one they are not familiar with. I did a podcast the other day where the guy was really keen on comics, but he was aware that I wrote Warhammer and he knew nothing about it. And I think by the end of the podcast, I've convinced him to go and read a Warhammer novel. I'm just doing my little bit there.
On that note, if you had to tell somebody one thing to go read, you know, what would it be?
What would I recommend someone go and read in terms of 40K. If I was trying to sort of indoctrinate someone into the realms of 40K, the point is there's so much great stuff to be read, and I'm not the only author doing it. So there's also things I recommend. Generally speaking, cheekily, I always suggest people go and read Eisenhorn, the first Eisenhorn book.
That's a solid recommendation. Yes.
Yeah, well, it seems to be, I'm encouraged to recommend that simply because that seems to me what Black Library itself recommends, that over years since it was first published, Eisenhorn is the book that is regarded as a sort of gateway drug to 40K, because it's you don't have to know a lot in order to get into it. The storyline carries you along, but you then learn a lot as you're going. Whereas, although I'm very proud of things like Horus Rising, for example, that's a pretty deep dive for your first step in. There's an awful lot of stuff there which you won't really understand the significance of unless you've got some familiarity with the universe. So I guess Xenos would be the place I would recommend people start.
What is it like stepping into that situation to where, like with Horus Heresy, you mentioned all the context. I mean, for us, the context was three pages in an old book published, in the early 90s or whatever. But then our minds took over and then made this vast, epic, universe-spanning landscape. Like, how do you even approach stepping into something like that with the weight of everyone's expectations on? And I don't... You may have thought about that. I'm not trying to give you the sweats or anything. I just want to know if that occurred to you.
Huge amount of caution and awareness of the pressure involved in trying to get something like that right. I mean, I was aware of Warhammer, both Warhammer and Warhammer 40K, since it first arrived in the 80s, mainly because of a misspent youth as a role-playing gamer playing Dungeons & Dragons and Call of Cthulhu and Traveller and
Wait
Rune
a
Quest
and stuff like all that. That's cool now. You can actually talk about it.
Like, yes. I'm no longer ashamed to admit any of that. So as a result, growing up in the UK, playing those games, most of those were imported by Games Workshop before they launched Warhammer. And the original incarnation of White Dwarf was a kind of comprehensive magazine about role-playing games. It wasn't just Warhammer. It was all sorts of features. So I read that on a regular basis. And I'd kind of stopped. I think college and stuff had got in the way. And I'd sort of been aware of GW launching its own games and its own universe, but not as something I played. And it was, I'd been working as a comic book writer, predominantly for Marvel, for a best part of a decade, I suppose, when the Black Library, newly founded Black Library, contacted me and asked me essentially to audition to write fiction for them. And I was one of a number of people contacted. And I sort of did it with great enthusiasm because I was immediately nostalgic for the role-playing game days and my memory of White Dwarf and everything like that. And to pass the audition, you obviously had to be able to write and be a professional, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it was more about capturing the atmosphere of 40K and of Warhammer. And so although I wasn't incredibly well-versed in the lore at that point, I sort of summoned up my memory of, John Blanche illustrations and that kind of stuff and just got the flavor of it and wrote for them. And they went, yeah, great. We can correct the factual errors, but you've got the atmosphere. So that's when I started writing for them comic strips and short stories. And that eventually led to the first novels, and the first key one being the beginning of the Gaunt's Ghost series. So from that point on, it was a very happy relationship where although there was an awful lot of lore to learn, it was a matter of crafting stuff. So the Gaunt's Ghost series, I was building, I was inventing world building stuff in that just to give it a context. And I was creating vocabulary that is now used throughout the universe because there wasn't a word for certain things. So I invented them. So that was all very rewarding and slightly freeing. And again, I had editors looking at me going, oh, you can't call it that. It needs to be called something else or whatever. But then as the Black Library grew and it went in a space of a very short number of years from being nothing at all to a very, very prominent publisher of science fiction, very successful publisher of science fiction. At that point, they decided to do the Horus Heresy, decided it was time to do that as a major series. And that was an intimidating prospect. Again, I was asked in as one of a sort of core group of writers. We've always had a writer's room on that series. So we've got novelists who are used to working on their own, in their own ridiculous seclusion and cabin fever, not having any social interaction with the outside world, just writing stuff. And here we were expected to sit down in the same room and be nice to each other and try and fashion a...
To share characters.
Yeah, exactly. To share characters, to share ideas And to do that in a kind of very democratic way, because so anyway, it's an experiment that might not have worked, but we were all so excited right from that early days. I remember those first few meetings, and you said, as you said, the Horus Heresy stuff was covered in, you know, it was mentions, odd mentions in codexes and in rule books, and almost all of it was color text, and there was sort of very little you could sink your teeth into. And we had the most amazing briefing sessions from, at the time it was Alan Merritt, who would come in with all these ancient white dwarfs and rule books all marked with post-it notes. And he'd go through them one by one and go through every single mention that had ever been made of the Horus Heresy so that we could sort of collate this fabric of what had been said and, you know, what we had to stick to and where the gaps were and what we could do and et cetera, et cetera. And even that, he admitted that it was full of contradictions because it had been made up on the fly. Really. And it was one of those things where we were taking something that was the Warhammer equivalent of the first mention of the Clone Wars in the original Star Wars movie. You know, this incredibly suggestive and atmospheric idea that where there was actually very little detail attached to it, and thinking, what do we do and how do we portray that? And we began to build this scheme. And I think we would have been stopped in our tracks by sheer performance pressure, that the idea that if we got it wrong, people would hate us. That was overcome by the enthusiasm of working as a team and the sheer excitement that we were getting to do it. And that, I think, carried us forward. And we sort of ran with it. And the lineup of writers involved has changed in some ways over the years, but we've kept it going. And again, going back to those early meetings, I remember us sort of even at the first few meetings talking about how we would reach the end. And what it would be like to reach the end and what our destination was. We had no idea, I have to say, that it was going to be 60 plus novels.
Yeah.
I think we thought maybe 20 tops. And it just grew and grew and grew. And that's partly because of its success and partly because the more you told, the more we realized there was more to tell and there was really interesting things we could do with it. So it's really weird in the last, I guess, 18 months, 2 years, as the illustrious roster for the writers for the Siege of Terror, which is the ending sequence, have been chosen and gathered together, and we've met. Those writers' room meetings, which have always been incredibly entertaining and very, very funny and creative, suddenly sort of became a very strange thing where we realized that after X number of years, we were finally doing the thing we talked about so many years ago, which was bringing it to a conclusion, which, if anything, was a bigger pressure than starting it in the first place, because we were young and innocent then and we thought we could get away with stuff, and now we knew we couldn't. So the attention to detail now is even more sort of intense than it was then. But luckily we have formed a very very good working relationship, and it really is a case where we meet and it's lighthearted, but it's intense. And we get through the long days of discussion by making a lot of jokes, most of which are completely unrepeatable. But one day they will, I'm sure, publish the the minutes of the meeting. To
Black Library After Dark.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely.
Behind the scenes.
Director's cut, behind the scenes, that kind of stuff. But we found that one of the most exciting things about it is that we'd sit around the table and we'd brainstorm a bit. And it quickly became evident that we were all capable of really good ideas. But there were certain great ideas that have made their way into the series that would not have happened if one of us hadn't been sitting at the table hearing somebody else say something that prompted that kind of intuitive spark that would not have otherwise occurred. And we would often come out we would throw ideas onto the table. So I might suggest something that I thought was a great storyline, not because I wanted to write it or was sort of earmarking it to write myself, but just to put it out there. And quite often it would end up being somebody else who wrote it. And none of us ever felt any kind of resentment that we'd done that, because the idea was to keep the whole thing moving, because it needed to keep moving.
I have to imagine that when you're writing, and please tell me where I'm wrong here, this is just me imagining, but when you write a character, you create a character, you kind of live in their skin for a bit and, you know, walk around through the chapter and or the story and stuff. What's it like seeing someone else do that? Something, you know, going to, you know, what's something that might be kind of, you know, intimate, or a relationship that you've got with these characters you create, watching someone else do something with it.
You certainly do live in the characters. I mean, I think that's the only way that a writer can really effectively write character, is to really try and feel what it's like to be them, no matter who they are. And you do feel a certain proprietorial ownership of characters you've created or characters you've written a lot of. But you've got to bear in mind, from my point of view, I came from 10 plus years of writing other people's characters anyway, because I've worked for very used to sort of taking up somebody else's character, trying to do a good job of it without ruining what they've done, and trying not to break the toys. And I, maybe for some of the other writers in the room who didn't necessarily have that experience, comics are a very communal creative activity. So maybe some of the other writers that was a little harder. And there have been moments. I mean, we have had arguments about the best way to do with a character or a writer going, no, I really, really want to write that bit about that character because it's my character. But they are minimal, and usually they're completely forgivable because somebody's invested an awful lot of time and effort into a particular thing. But I suppose it was weird. Yes, it was weird. It was slightly weird for me the first time I saw somebody else writing, you know, Loken and some of the other characters that I had created specifically for the story. But it's also very exciting when you kind of get them back, when these characters return to you. And it's also, you know, delightful when you get to play with characters that other people have created, as I've done in some of my other novels, particularly as, you know, Saturnine, my Siege of Terror novel, which comes out very, very shortly. It has got pretty much everybody who's still alive in the story in it one way or another. So I was writing characters that I hadn't written before, and I had to get my head around them, and I had to go and read what other people had done and check up on them. And I was talking constantly to the other writers, not only in the meetings, but we had a pretty much ongoing email thread where I would just ask questions, and everybody was, and I'm doing the same now for the other writers. You know, we would just sometimes when you're writing a novel, if you've got to stop and go and look something up in detail, it really breaks the flow. So to be able to send off a quick group email and say, what was the name of that guy who was second on the left in that scene there? You know, has he got anything? And then everybody writes back and goes, that's it. And you kind of, we sort of do the heavy lifting for each other to a certain extent. I mean, there is a lot of research, but you do that heavy lifting. And it meant that I've had email conversations with, and indeed Skype conversations with some of the other authors in the process of writing the novel, where I've really sort of dismantled with their help who a character is that they've created so I can write them properly. And then suggested ways that we can set things up. You know, I can set things up in a novel so that somebody else can pick up on it. And, you know, so that collaborative process has worked tremendously well. And I hope it's I hope the end result is as pleasing. You know, and sometimes there's even a case where very subtly, and I'm not going to mention any specifics, but very subtly where you can correct a mistake that's already happened, where, you know, some sort of a writer will come to the table and go, I've just realized that three novels ago I said this and that was sort of not completely correct, and we'll work out how to fix it, and then in the next book somebody else will just gently, as an aside, fix it. And so somebody going, oh, it turns out it was that after all. And I think that's, you know, that sort of corrective effort where you can follow on from each other and sort of make sure everything dovetails is good. It's good. It's a good.
So it really is a team sport, is what you're saying.
It really is. It really is a team sport. And you know, we have all sorts of weird sort of habits now that we, you know, but it is, like I said, I think the real thing is that authors are a really solitary species, and to get six or seven of them in a room for a day or two, much against our best judgment, it really is fun. And we enjoy it, and we look forward to it, and we come away with more than we were bargaining for. And like I said, those days are regularly interrupted by ridiculous ideas and good humor and all sorts of. For a while we referred to ourselves, very jokingly, I hasten to add, we referred to ourselves as the High Lords, or the High Lords of Terror, because we would meet in a room that had a huge imperial aquila on the outside of it. And so we felt that we were the High Lords of Terror, and that was the joke. And then we started to sort of occasionally behave as a sort of assembly, like a parliament, where we'd all go sort of, yes. When somebody said something good, you know, sort of a murmur of approval, like we were sort of in the House of Lords. And somebody commented that the noises we were making doing that sounded like, you know, those child's nursery toys that are a plastic cup that when you tip them over, they make the mooing noise of a cow. I'm sure you've seen these things.
I know what you're talking about. Yep.
Yes. Okay. Right. So we refer to our murmurs of approval as the cow tip noise. And then just as a laugh last year, I discovered that you could still buy those cheaply on Amazon. So I got a box full, and now we all go to the meetings with one. So we just turn the cow pots over and make the mooing noise every time somebody says something that we did.
I'm imagining Perfect. You all wearing fancy hats now.
Oh, yes.
And then there's every time there's a moo noise, there's like a rating that comes up on screen. Like, I got four cow tips. And so it's going to make the cut.
Yeah. I have often suggested that we did do it in cosplay, but there'd be a whole another round of preparation for that, and then people would, you know what would happen, you know, we'd get Guy and Graham both turning up as the same character, oh, and then there's an argument.
Man, that is really cool. I should have mentioned this earlier. Red's in the military over here in the States. And you see, I mean, one of the great things about your stories is that you seem to capture that military and war like really, really well. Do you have any experience with that stuff in the past, or does that just come natural? Or, well, Red, I mean, let me know. It sounds good to me. It sounds very realistic. But do you have any experience, or like what's your connection to that it translates so well into the stories?
I haven't, no, and thank you for saying so. I put a lot of effort into research, to be fair. There is subject matter that interests me. I remember fairly early on, I'd written several novels for the Black Library, and I was at an American convention, an American Games Day, and somebody came up to me, and they were, I think, a serving Marine, and they said they really enjoyed my novels for that very reason, that it captures something. And they asked me, are you a veteran? And I have to say, it was one of the biggest compliments I'd ever been paid, because apparently I'd captured that sense of camaraderie and the sort of the right tone. But that comes through research. I read a lot. I read a lot of real world factual material about warfare of any era whatsoever. And also, because there is a large representation of serving or ex-military in the readership, American, British, when I go to Europe, you know, all around the world, I get to talk to really interesting people, and they tell me stuff, and it's not necessarily stuff I use directly, but they tell me stories because they think I'm going to be interested. And sometimes the spirit of those stories is something that I can carry over and use with their permission, because it seems to be an effective thing to do. And I've heard some great stories, and I have several, I've made good friends with several of them who I sort of, if I need to, can email and ask a specific question. How does this work? What is this like? And get some information there. So I have one friend who is a pilot with the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force. I have another friend who was in US counterintelligence, and all sorts of different things where I can ask people questions and they come up with great answers. And this is not just military either. I met a particle physicist and a sort of computing genius and a mathematician. And again, they sort of all go into my little Rolodex of in emergency, send email sort of, I think you can never do too much research is what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, and I just have to say, Dan, that again, coming from where I'm at and reiterating some of what you've already said, and man, you've absolutely, you know, you look at even Gaunt's Ghosts and how it's all spread out, not just, you know, Gaunt himself, as it's just such a good piece of leadership himself and how you've taken it and extrapolated in his dealings with other military elements and agencies. It's just such a good read. And like you said, focusing on the character, I've just appreciated reading it so much that it's been such a, as far as sci-fi novels go, not just 40K alone, but it's been such a core piece of literature that I've enjoyed so much, man. And just thank you so much for lending the writing to that kind of the spirit of that character, because it has meant so much, not just to me, but so many other people that from the military that have appreciated where you've gone with it.
Well, thank you for saying so. That does mean an enormous amount, and it always does when I have contact with readers who say that sort of thing. I know that my books go out to PXs in different war zones, and my books have been read under fire, just about everything you can possibly imagine. And I can't believe that would happen if I wasn't getting something right. Although I did ask the question very early on to some soldiers I met, and I said, why do you read this? It's made up science fiction, shooty death kill in space. It's not even attempting to be realistic in terms of any kind of real world conflict, and people seem to what they seem to like was the mix of sheer escapism with the fact that the people in that escapism behaved like real soldiers, or to the best of my ability, behaved like real soldiers. And I think that's one of the things I do, no matter what I do, not just military science fiction, but whatever I'm writing, because it generally falls into the category of science fiction or fantasy, and therefore is completely made up. I always want it to feel authentic. The science fiction that I as a reader enjoy reading is the stuff that I'm completely believing in, even if it is something that doesn't exist and is completely fantastical. If the writer can communicate to me in a way that feels authentic, that's great. So I've said this before actually, but I always go and basically research as deeply as possible the kind of real world analogues to certain things, the things that that are closest to the fantastical things that I'm talking about, so that I can then translate that information across and make them more believable. So, for instance, in Titanicus, which obviously is about giant walking war machines, which don't actually exist anywhere really. So I thought, well, how do I research that? And actually, I realized the best way to research that was to read a book about, or many books, in fact, about other conflicts where people were in sort of claustrophobic environments. So I read books about tank warfare, and I read books about U-boat warfare and submarine warfare. And then I sort of translated the kind of feeling that I got from that across into Titans and wrote them that way, as if they were giant upright submarines, you know, and after a while, that sort of thing. And to me, that makes them feel more credible. And that presumably is what I'm getting across to the reader. I don't write to please myself by any stretch of the imagination. I think a writer's on a fool's errand if they do that. But by the same token, I figure if I don't believe it and I'm not enjoying the story, then no other bugger is gonna. So I try and make sure I believe in it. And the same, I take my cue from writers of science fiction or otherwise, writers of fiction who convince me that what they're telling me is real and whose stories completely captivate me so that I forget I'm reading a book and start living that experience. And that could be almost anything, but you know, the sort of if I'm ever doing that, then I'm accomplishing what I set out to do.
As a tank officer, Dan, I'll tell you, Titanicus did exactly that. It is a remarkable connection in some of the things that you convey and what the person feels from what you're reading and what the, you know, the pilots or the princeps that are in charge of the Titans. Yep. And whatnot. I mean, it is just, you absolutely captured it. And I, you know, even from Gaunt's Ghost and the tank officers and that and the tank soldiers, and it's just such an amazing capture that you did in those stories.
Well, thank you very much. And again, that's a really weird thing, because as I obviously established, there's an awful lot of research goes in. So that sometimes novels flow and you write two or three chapters in a day, and sometimes you'd write down to a sort of crawl trying to get stuff things in, because you're stopping every paragraph to check out something. And usually it is 40K lore that you're checking out. You know, you're sort of having a quick check of the codexes to make sure that you haven't called the character the wrong thing or got his rank wrong or whatever else, what's the insignia of this unit, whatever else it is. And it does help when it actually is stuff that you've invented for the universe, because then you've only got yourself to blame. But sometimes I have to wade through stuff trying to find it. But the bits that really slow me down are the bits where I try and do something real world. You mentioned the tanks there in the Gaunt's Ghost series. And I thought to myself, naively, I went, oh, tank combat, that would be great to put in a Gaunt's Ghost book. Each Gaunt's Ghost book, I tried to give a different, it was, you know, within the limits allowed for infantry warfare stories, because it was still about Gaunt's Ghost. So I tried to do as many different things so the books weren't the same every time. So we got a trench warfare one, and we got a sort of parachute raid one, and we got a behind the lines book, and we got a, you know, each one had tried to have a different feel. And I thought, oh, tank warfare, that'll be great. And then I started to write about tanks, thinking blithely, I've seen war films, I know what tanks are like. And then realized I knew nothing at all, absolutely nothing at all. And I kept stopping, and I had my room was covered in encyclopedias of tank warfare and how weapons work and what does this thing here do, just so I thought, somebody's going to get me, somebody's going to really, you know, afterwards they're going to go, I don't care that you got all the 40K details wrong, but tanks do not work like that.
How many of the emails you get start with, actually...
Actually, do you know what? I have to say very, very, very few indeed come to me with that kind of heavy, and that's not saying I don't make mistakes, but very few of them come to me with a kind of, dear Mr. Abnett, what the hell were you thinking? You know, sort of, here's your key. I'm going to go. It's more a case of I read the latest book. I really enjoyed it. I noticed you were calling this. Technically it's correct, because obviously it's 40K and you're allowed some leeway, but I thought you'd be interested to know that actually you might want to call these things this, you know, and it's like, that's fantastic. It's like, you know, you're happy to go along with what I've done, but you thought of a way of maybe improving it. And then you give me this background information, which is great. There are so many instances where every universe guards its own law very, very carefully. I remember when I was an editor back at Marvel Comics, and we were doing my friend was the editor of the G.I. Joe comic in the UK, or what we call the Action Force. And he'd come in on a Saturday to do some paste-ups, doing some overtime. And the phone rang in the Marvel offices. And he picked it up, and somebody, it was a reader saying, "Yeah, I thought I'd ring up to say I've just seen the latest issue, and you had some helicopter. I can't remember what it was. It was Black Hawks or something. You had some Black Hawks, and the tail number had too many digits in it. There were too many digits." And my friend, who was scrupulous, as he's even more a military buff than I am, just went, "Haven't you got something better to do on a Saturday?" And hung up. And just, there comes a point. So I know that fan base, you know, Doctor Who fan base or the Star Trek fan base or whatever, they will pick you up if you make a mistake. When I started writing Legion of Superheroes for DC Comics about 20 years ago, they have possibly the most ferociously on it fan base of all, and they were constantly sending those correctives. But weirdly, 40K is incredibly receptive. They sort of embrace these things. They don't go, "Oh, you made a mistake." They go, "You could have done that a little bit better. Here's some suggestions how." And I wonder whether that's because a lot of the readers are coming from the hobby, where they are used to the sort of building it from scratch way of doing it. Do you know what I mean? They're used to building their own armies and finessing as they go along and adjusting things and getting it better incrementally on that hobby basis of week by week by week, rather than just like it's right from the word go. And I think they look at the fiction almost in the same light, that it's almost sort of we're accumulating a body of novels in the way that we would accumulate an army, and it allows us to finesse as we go along. That's great, because in the same way that your friend might lend you a pot of paint or something because to help you with your army, people come along with information in the same sort of way. And I've always appreciated that. And like I said, some of the stories I've heard have been absolutely fantastic.
That's really cool. And it's very encouraging about what we see in our show too, is that the people that write in, they genuinely, you know, they want to make sure that we are aware of something to make the show and stuff even better. And it's really nice to see that translates to other areas, you know, with this.
Yeah.
Something they care about. They care about it, and they want you to know they care about it. And that's really nice to hear.
I'm often surprised when I hear stories, and they're more prevalent, unfortunately, these days, of that kind of toxic fandom, which you see. I mean, and it's not complete. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Star Wars, for instance. I really love Star Wars films. And most Star Wars fans love Star Wars in the same way that most Star Trek fans love Star Trek. But there is a core in there where it seems like they just want to be destructive of the one thing that they love. They won't say, "I liked it, but I would have liked it more if this happened." They just go, "I hate it because of this." You know, when they talk about the latest Star Wars films, or Star Trek fans talk about Discovery and Picard, and it's like, well, maybe it's not done the way you would like it to be done, and you know, but it is that idea of hammering something. When I'm going, well, if you are that negative towards it, eventually people won't want to make the effort to make it anymore. And I think the idea of a fandom that is perhaps critical in a constructive way, yet is also eager for it, just because they want it to improve, not stop. I think
that's a great point. If I can change gears for a little bit here, you also seem to inject a human element into some of your like Space Marine novels and stuff. I mean, like the Remembrancers and stuff from original, you know, Horus Rising. Number one, do you? I mean, that's. I don't know if it's taken directly from like City of London Parliament, but you know, they have that office. Is there a connection between those things? And then my next question past that is, are you using those human elements just as a literary device, or do you think what part do you think they play in the tapestry of the story?
Well, I draw inspiration from all over the place. You can't see me holding this up because this is audio only, but I carry notebooks wherever I go, and anything that I think is interesting, an interesting word, an interesting name, an interesting piece of history, or, you know, I visit a stately home or a castle and discover something, goes in the book. So I can use these things. So the influences are drawn from everywhere. And I think in 40K, that's legit, because of course we're drawing from all of Earth history, and you can have all sorts of references there. And it's, I guess it's up to the readers to go, is that a reference to that? Or is that just a coincidence? And I love the idea. There is this kind of rich fabric of human history that the 40K universe is built on. But the human element, as you put it, to me is absolutely vital to sustain 40K fiction. The 40K universe is incredible. It's a brilliant place to game in. It's a, you know, it's got all these wonderful things going for it. But I think to keep the books interesting, we have to, at the heart of it, attach, the reader has to be able to attach themselves and identify with people in the stories. If we started writing the books as sort of pure bolter porn, you know, shooty death, kill in space, they would have been really interesting. We could have described the hell out of some amazing battles, and it could have been big and wonderful and all that kind of stuff. But after a few novels, I just think people will be going, oh God, it just never stops. It's just the same tonal quality all the way through, this spectacle that is ultimately hollow. And I love writing for 40K, but I could not have written the number of novels I've written if I wasn't also connecting to the characters, because ultimately any story to me is driven by the people in it. And if you don't care about those people, and you don't understand who they are, and you don't identify with them, and you don't share their hopes and dreams, or you know, hope they make it out alive, then after a while, the books are just going to be repetitive. So that's definitely the case with things like Gaunt's Ghost. I mean, that's, 15 novels long now? That series has only continued. I said I'd write it until I ran out of ideas for stories, but ultimately, I think the truth there is I'll write it until I run out of characters. And I don't just mean by killing them off. I just mean as long as there are character storylines that are moving along, I can think of circumstances to put them into. And sometimes it takes multiple novels to pay something off. And there's, you know, and the latest book out, which was Anarch, was a huge punctuation point and a sort of end stop to that arc. But anybody who's read that series knows that there's so many other things waiting to be picked up on, so many other personal strands of story strands. So to me, Gaunt's Ghosts, it might be a military SF, but to me, it's just a big soap opera about people who happen to be soldiers in this regiment. And that's, to me, what sustains it. And I'm sure that's what ultimately sustains a readership's interest in a long-running series. The same is true of the Eisenhorn and Inquisitor books, Eisenhorn, Ravenna, and now the Beckwin series, is that you know, they're fun, they're full of cool stuff, but they've also got to have the characters driven in it. And I think that's one of the reasons it took me a long time to write Space Marines, because by their very nature, they have less personality than a human being. You know, a human being in the 40K universe might be in the very far future, so it's very different to us, but they're still a human being who has the same sort of range of emotions and you know, sort of needs. But a Space Marine is very, very different. So it took me a long time to get a handle on how to write Space Marines so that they could be differentiatable characters. And that was actually easier with the Horus Heresy, where they had more personality. It was back from a time where they were given more sort of idiosyncrasies, and they sort of weren't quite so uniform and regimented. And so that is a really interesting place. And in the Horus Heresy, you mentioned the remembrances there, but obviously, although the main characters in the Horus Heresy, generally speaking, are Primarchs and Space Marines, the purpose of the story is about the future of mankind. It's about the human race and about whether it can be protected and guarded and looked after. So we are following characters who are looking after humans, essentially. So to have human voices in there to represent the sort of the body of mankind that these Space Marines are going to war about, to me, wasn't just an interesting addition. It was, again, absolutely vital. And I like the fact that these characters are there. I love it when you have a scene where a Space Marine is, as it were, talking respectfully to a human being in those circumstances, rather than just sort of wandering past them as like some sort of god, because they're all in that together and it all matters. And they respect the human point of view, even though if they completely outclass them in terms of their physicality. So I think it's a matter of trying to make a cohesive universe with humans in it, where the human behavior makes sense and therefore is something that no matter how weird and wild and fantastical everything else is, the reader can connect to that. And it sort of gives them sort of a support and a point of identification that they can run with.
Yeah, one of the most brilliant things about the series itself is that everything's a character. The ships are characters. The planets are characters. You know, like it's a real testament to you guys' writing.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I you need to do that. I mean, again, I world building, another great love of mine. In the Siege of Terror books, I spent an awful lot of time last year mapping the Palace of Terror because I wanted to make sure I knew where everything was. And when you consider the Palace of Terror is the size of Belgium, that was, you know, that was a long weekend.
How many restrooms are in the palace?
I have a list. But it's one of those things where to me it matters. It matters that you sense that there is a sense that the places are real. It's not just like, you know, a desert planet. Or a place where it was raining on Mars that morning. No, it wasn't. It might have been raining on this bit of Mars, but Mars is a planet. It's huge. What else is there? You know, what are those sort of complexities that you can build into these places so that, again, people think they're real. And that, I suppose, is where the research starts to stray into geography and learning about other parts of the world and what they call things and how things work. And, you know, I think that's again an essential part of it. And sometimes you're right. Sometimes inanimate things become characters in a way that, you know, sort of that they have a possession. Otherwise, it's the same. I think it's the same drive that will make people build the most amazing scenery for their tabletop battles. Because a, you know, a blank or squared off gaming board isn't realistic enough. They want to feel invested in it. They want the scenery to move behind and that kind of stuff. I think that's the same thing we're trying to do in the novels, really.
That's really fair. You've mentioned, you know, games a few times. Do you play? Do you play D&D still? Do you play any kind of 40K or any of this stuff? Do you have a game that you like that you're go to unwind and relax? Well,
yes and no. I do not play anything very often because I like doing it so much. The same reason I don't play video games very often is because I would never get any work done. I know what I'm like and I would get addicted. I did play, like I said, a vast amount of role-playing game stuff back when I was a teenager. And I think, and I was often the referee or dungeon master back then. And I think that ability to spontaneously create stuff as I went along, which I often did, I would just invent madly to stay ahead of the players. That helped me in terms of it sort of built up the muscles that I now use for story writing, that sort of spontaneous storytelling thing, which I still use to this day. After a long hiatus, I have started to recently, in the last year or so, to play D&D again, running a game for my friend and his sons, which has been enormously good fun.
It's amazing.
And I forgot how much I love doing it. It made me dig out all my old books and my old miniatures and all these things that have been hanging around for years and years and years in a box in the attic. And so that was great fun. And I have made sure that I have played pretty much every version of Warhammer and Warhammer 40K and all the different associated games at least once. So I understand what it's like to play them. And I like to have a top-up game every now and then. I live in a town that's got a branch of Games Workshop. It's only a small Games Workshop store. But if I need to, I can ring the manager up and he'll set up a sort of practice game on a club night. And I can go down there and say, you know, I can ring him up and say, I've never played Battlefleet Gothic. And he goes, right, next Tuesday. And you know, don't do it very often, but that's a really interesting experience. And therefore there are games there that I really enjoy. I have to say, I really, really enjoy Battlefleet Gothic and Titanicus. I don't know why those two in particular. I mean, I love playing 40K and I love playing Inquisitor as well. And I used to like playing Gorka Morka when Gorka Morka was a thing. But those two sort of strategic war machine games, I think, are two of my favourites. And I'm either very good at them or I got very lucky on the instances that I played and just walked away with tremendous victories.
But could be a natural.
Well, maybe not. I'm not sure. Maybe they're just being nice to me because they're playing my playing that club night. But don't kill his Titan. I don't. You know, there's all sorts of possibilities. But it's not just to me. Those playing those games is not just a matter of understanding how the games work. So I get a feel of them and can somehow reproduce that. To me, it was a matter of observing what it's like for other people to play it. In other words, to discover why people played the games. And it's not just because they like the game. That's too simple an answer, because I remember vividly several games I played with people I didn't really know, I hadn't necessarily met before, six or seven people around the table, and I realized that they were all playing for different reasons, i.e. the pleasure they were deriving from the game was different. So there was one guy who was all about the miniatures, absolutely all about the miniatures, and took great love and pride in that. There was another guy who was all about the game mechanics and the dice roll. There was another guy who was all about the tactics. There was another guy who was all about, essentially, about the lore and the world building, and sort of was role playing his way into being this general in this army. So they, each one of them was appreciating, if you like, a different aspect of exactly the same game that we were all playing. And that was a really interesting thing. And I remember taking that away almost as a kind of checklist, that when I was writing, for instance, battle scenes in a Warhammer novel, I would try and subtly at least make sure there was something in that scene for each of those archetypal players. You know, something that reflected the tactics, something that reflected the description, something that reflected the nature of the soldiers, something that reflected the luck of the dice roll, you know, that kind of stuff. Because I know that everybody plays 40K and every other game in their own way, that you come to it for your own reasons. It's not because I like toy soldiers, I'm going to play a game. It's not as simple as that. There is such a diversity. There's so many people, for instance, who love the game simply because of the fiction. They don't play the game.
Yeah.
They love the fiction. There are loads of people who don't really play the game very often because they love too much painting the miniatures. and building the armies. They don't necessarily want to deploy those armies. They just want to do that. So everyone's got their own thing. And without being sort of unnecessarily sort of mechanical about it, I really try and make sure that, those things are reflected in the novels, that no matter what you're interested in, you can find a little bit of it sort of mirrored in the course of a book.
Well, you're killing it. And I can, I mean, hearing you say that, I think that subconsciously we feel that with the stories we read from you. That's absolutely amazing.
Thank you.
If I know we only have a couple of minutes left, but I'd like to touch briefly, if we can, although Marvel Comics. I mean, I don't know how we briefly cover this, but maybe you can come on again in the future. But Marvel Comics, like you've had your hands on some titans of that industry, Silver Surfer, you know, Guardians of the Galaxy that have become mega, Thanos. I mean, come on. I mean, Punisher. Yeah. I mean, these are things that people love. But if I want to talk just, if I can, briefly about Nova, like you made. Okay. I think you made us as a collective fan base care about Nova when maybe he wasn't a big thing for folks before.
Well, he wasn't. I do have a habit of working for Marvel and for DC and for all the different people I've worked for over the years. Quite often I get handed either characters that need fixing slightly or characters that people that aren't that interested in to see if I can do anything with them. I don't know if that's an accident or coincidental or whether I've just got a reputation for doing that. But the Cosmic Run at Marvel was a particularly fun thing to do. Obviously, as you say, I wrote the Nova book, and then out of that we built the Guardians of the Galaxy, which is the version that has become now filmed, which was a weird experience to go through. But in all of those things, I was aware that these were characters who had some success in the past, but were not considered to be sort of, you know, A-grade Marvel characters. And so there was a sense of, can you fix them? Can you do anything with them? Can you make these characters work in a way they've not worked before? And that was done in a number of different ways. With the Guardians, to me, it was a matter of, I had a huge love of cosmic superheroes, mm-hmm. And therefore a ridiculously intimate knowledge of some of the lesser ones, the characters that had been tried and had failed and were now lying discarded, never to be used again. And I was thinking, no, I think we can make those work. And maybe it's a matter of putting them together in a team. And maybe it's a matter of, you know, sort of pairing them up into interesting relationships and that kind of stuff. And again, with Nova, he had some success in his first time around. And I thought, I think there's something more, potentially more here. And so I kind of, what I tried to do was to look at what was wrong with Nova, which is to say that he was considered by readers to be a sort of third or fourth rate Marvel hero. He wasn't up there with the big guys.
A clone of another character from another property, only as like a side character in a Spider-Man comic, he'd show up every now and then or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So he was that, but he had potential. And so I thought, well, one of the best things that I can do, and it's a tactic I've employed in several different places, but I thought, can I make the character of Richard Rider aware of his status in the Marvel universe so that it is comparable to his status as a character to the readers? So I starting out with the idea that Richard Rider knows that he's not the biggest hero in the universe, and that he sort of is in awe of the big guys like Thor and Captain America and stuff like that, and he's never going to be as big or important as those. And then put him in a position where he realizes that in that sort of cosmic war of annihilation as a starting point, that he becomes important, he becomes very powerful. And when he returns to Earth, to have the other heroes now look at him as if he has sort of jumped several leagues and is now in the top division simply because of his significance in the universe. And I thought it was really useful to have the reader's expectation matching with the character's expectation and to play around with them so that you get to a point where if Iron Man says Nova is an important character, maybe the readers will also understand that Nova is an important character and sort of play around with it like that. I think it's quite often you don't want to do it too hard, but to have a character aware of their own status helps you do things with that character because they strive harder or they realize they've got something to prove or whatever. And I think that's quite a good thing. But as I say, I love writing the cosmic stuff. And when Marvel Studios decided to turn Guardians into a movie, I was astonished. I mean, absolutely astonished, because we'd had a certain amount of success with the book, but it was not considered to be a major property, and it was just a matter of doing cosmic stories until we could, you know, and we got away with so much because there was these were characters that people didn't really necessarily care about.
Yeah, flexibility, then, I guess, right? I mean,
just huge flexibility. Not the same. If I'd been writing, I don't know, Iron Man or Cap or something like that, the restrictions would have been much greater. But with Star-Lord and the others, it was like, oh, you can pretty much do anything and no one's going to come and shout at you. So it's all these stories that I think were interesting and sort of unpredictable because they could go anywhere. And then they made this movie and sort of go from a point where I felt like I was one of three people on the planet who knew who Rocket Raccoon was to a place where I can walk down the street and everyone's got a Rocket Raccoon, you know, sort of bag or hat or shoes or whatever. It was a weird, weird experience. But you know, sort of I love the fact that they sort of made that leap and became household names. And it's the same as when I look at a 40K novel or a 40K codex and I see terminology being used that I know that 20 years ago I invented and added to the universe. And then I don't want to get a credit for it every single time they crop up or anything like that, but it's just like nice seeing people use words like Voxcaster and Prometheum and stuff like that and thinking, oh God, that's I've added to that universe in a lasting way.
Yep.
In the same way to you know, I didn't create Rocket Raccoon. I just used him in a way that made him more successful. And I love the fact that, that now he is, you know, sort of recognizable beyond the comics medium, that people recognize the character or they recognize Groot and they go, I know who that is. That's a character like I recognize, I don't know, Mickey Mouse or Bart Simpson or whatever. And that's lovely. And it's not like I want everybody to run up and thank me or anything. I just get a kick out of seeing that transformation and that recognition taking place. So, you know, that's very cool. Plus, of course, when they start making movies of things that you've been associated with, you do get like set visits and go to the premiere and stuff like that. So, you know, I got to visit the set of Guardians and meet the cast and watch them filming. And that was pretty incredible. That was a, you know, pretty incredible thing to do. And then to go to the premiere, I went to the premiere in London. Got to walk down the, well, it was a blue carpet, but I got to walk down the red carpet. And just that was tremendously exciting, seeing the film properly for the first time. All of those experiences, that's, you know, going back to what I was saying about the Horus Heresy writer's room, we're all very solitary people who live in a single room typing all day. And then to go out and have something exciting like that, I mean, I get a kick out of it too. I don't think I would be writing comics and science fiction if I wasn't a fan. So occasionally the fanboy in me gets to benefit from that and just really, really enjoy it. You know,
absolutely. I'm trying not to let mine come out completely right now, but you know, the Marvel, the cosmic stuff about Marvel, I had always been in love with the idea of it, but the writing that you gave actually gave me something to sink my teeth into with it, and to see that it has trailed off to become these cool things larger than just.
I appreciate that. I do think that one of the things there is that is the same. Again, it's the same as 40K. Is that I think a lot of people write space stories in the Marvel universe or the DC universe, come to that or anywhere else. They tend to write them in a kind of lighthearted, this can be silly sort of way. And there is enormous room for humor and ridiculousness and strangeness in those stories. But to me, they've got to be anchored in some kind of degree of realism in order to make the wonder more spectacular. In the same way that spaceships are rusty in Star Wars, it makes you believe the universe more. And I always thought that one of the big problems, you know, you're writing, say, Spider-Man, it's set on Earth, and you know what Earth is, so you've got it locked down. You've got a context for what's going on. But the moment you go out into space, it's like you invented names of planets and everything's, you know, darkness and stars. And it's like, so with the Marvel books, I tried to build a sort of cosmic geography using the existing elements of the great empires that were meant to be out there and how they would feud with each other and, you know, return to certain planets and all that, or just to have that sort of the sense of doing it. And I think that the training I got from that has probably come more than anything else from writing for comics like 2000 AD in the UK, which is very much a science fiction comic, and having a childhood that was more influenced by science fiction than it was by superheroes. In superheroes in the American sense, I love them dearly, but they were sort of an import that I got used to in my childhood, and then realized that that actually there were ways of combining them with more obviously science fiction elements. So I don't know. I suppose it always comes down to a character and world building. So I'm beginning to sound like a cracked record, but that is to me where it all comes from.
No, that's awesome. Well, I mean, I know we're running over time here. If for some strange reason someone has just discovered you on this show, where can they go to find out more about you?
Goodness me. Well, there are so many things I could recommend in terms of stuff that I'm doing at the moment. So you can go out literally right now and read stuff. Like I said, the latest Siege of Terror novel, Saturnine, is out there for fans. It's just about to come out. I would recommend people, if they want to discover my 40K work, to start with something like Xenos, or maybe First and Only, which is the first Gorn's Ghost novel. They're both pretty good places to start. I'm writing Justice League Odyssey, which is the cosmic Justice League for DC. I'm writing Rye, who is the, funnily enough, futuristic character for the Valiant universe. And that's a book I'm enjoying enormously. And that was on hiatus because of the lockdown, but it restarts in August, and it's the sixth issue out then with a trade of the first five. So it's an ideal point to pre-order that and catch up with a story, which I think 40K fans would love, because it's not overtly superheroes. It's a strong science fiction story that happens to have a very dynamic hero in it. I write regularly for 2000 AD in this country. 2000 AD is the bastion of British comic publishing. It's the home of Judge Dredd. It's been going for since 1977, I think, on a weekly basis. I've write many, many stories in that, which are, you can either read in a weekly basis in 2000 AD or in the trade paperback collections of series that I've written for it. And so that's another place to go look. And I also write for games, so next time you sit down and play Alien Isolation or Shadow of Mordor, then you're probably encountering at least some of my dialogue in those sorts of things. And I would like to plug, just very quickly, I've worked with a game company in the UK for the last year or so, and they've just launched last week a game called Crayta, that's Crayta, which is on the Google Stadia, which is the online gaming platform. And Crayta's a really great game, and in order to support it and build a fictional context around that game, I've written a 6-part science fiction comic book in the American format, which is available on their website, on the Crayta website. And it's, you know, we've got some great artists working on it. It's a good science fiction thriller. And it was a fun thing to do because it expands stuff out. I always like that kind of odd challenge of going sort of sideways on something. So I am prolific and I'm all over the place. If you actually want to interface with me directly, I am on Twitter, but I don't use Twitter very often because I found it sort of not the place it used to be. But I'm on Instagram as Dabnet, Dabnet, all as one word. And I actually maintain a quite vigorous presence on Facebook. I have two personal pages, Dan Abnett and Daniel Abnett, both of which are pretty much at capacity now, but I kept them going as individual pages rather than as public figure pages because I wanted to be able to talk to people. But I think the time has come now where I'm going to migrate one or the other of them into a public figure page so that we can get more people involved, and maybe I can do Q&As or ask me anythings on that sort of stuff. So those would be, I guess, the places to look. And even if you can't friend me on Facebook, you can always send me a message there. And I do tend to look at the kind of pending messages file and answer stuff and answer direct questions wherever I can, you know, time permitting. But yeah, I try and do that.
Dan, this has been wonderful. Really appreciate you coming on and taking the time with us today.
It's been great. Thank you both for having me on, and thank you for the questions and for your patience as I witter on.
Have a great rest of your afternoon.
Thank you. You too.
FTN is also on Facebook. Please like us at www.facebook.com/ForgeTheNarrative.
We are back. Still got Adam and Red here.
I'm still Adam.
And Red.
As of this moment, I have the best Blood Angel Outriders in the world.
That being, you're saying you have the only Blood Angels Outriders in the world.
I'm saying that everyone else that has them has chosen to paint them something else. But for this moment, for the next couple of days, well, maybe not even by the time you hear this recording, but in this moment in time, I'm actually pretty happy with how they turned out. These are gorgeous models, and the Primaris, they seem to be a little easier to paint. Like, they get still the smooth lines, but now they've got that extra element, the extra 25 pieces of flair.
I can certainly tell you from painting a lot of Mark II and Mark III Marines recently, I'm mispainting my Black Templar Mark Xs. They are so much more fun to paint. The Mark II and Mark III guys from Horus Heresy, such a pain to edge highlight, is a real, real issue.
Well, on this episode, I'd like to talk about close combat, and there's been a lot of people mentioning that they think close combat is going to be severely hampered in this upcoming edition, and I don't disagree that it's going to be more difficult to do some of the things that we've become accustomed to doing, such as, you know, you burning things like fight twice to move, leapfrogging into other units, locking things up a little bit easier, touching things to where you can't shoot. Like, these are things that have fundamentally changed, And, you know, one of the reasons I went to the Outriders first for my painting was that I think they've got a couple of elements that are really going to assist in getting the assault off. And that they come with guns. You know, they come with decent amount of bolter shots to be able to clear what could be the new form of bubble wrap, which is going to be completely surrounding or doming off your high value targets. Like, yeah, I know vehicles can shoot even if they get touched and stuff, but you know, there's negatives and things that come with that, or even potential still putting them at risk for bracketing and whatever. So I think we're going to see a new type of bubble wrap evolving in ninth edition, and some guns help you get through that.
I think you hit the nail on the head. The Outrider is probably, I think, a really good example of what we might expect from a unit that can be in melee. And that, so I said can be in melee, not wants to be in melee. I think melee right now, and this might be indicative of if you were to transport your mind to the 41st millennium. I mean, there's a lot of suspension of disbelief, and that goes both ways. But I don't feel like in the 41st millennium, an army or a battle that is purely based on hand-to-hand combat, I believe that one army that is based on hand-to-hand combat is going to have a really bad time in the 41st millennium. Like, if we were to transport our minds there right now and picture ourselves there, if one army is running at an entrenched gun line and they want to hit you with a stick, the guys with the guns are going to win. I mean, that's true right now, Red, isn't it? Like,
well, I mean,
where was the last time anybody lost a modern battle to the guys with the swords, you know?
I mean, you know, we won't get into the whole Zulu thing. That's a whole other thing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, pride is something else altogether. But I mean, so being the guy that throughout 8th edition or a healthy part of it, I mean, I ran armies that my only ranged weapons were grenades.
Very brave.
And yeah, and it's not, so the whole complex of this whole deal is that obviously having a combined arms approach that's a healthy approach to the game. Now, can you skew to certain factors one way or the other? You can, absolutely, right? So you can skew to, I mean, like I was skewed heavily towards melee. You just have to understand that in certain cases that you have quite literally brought, you know, a chainsword to a bolter fight, and that, yeah, you're going to have to eat that. And have you planned for that? Have you anticipated what you're going to do about it? And so, no, like pure melee is obviously going to be at a disadvantage to in most regards in a lot of cases, and that's just something that you have to accept going into it. Your skew is going to be countered by one thing or another in any case that you skew. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to recommend to anybody that the best general approach up front is going to be to go all melee. I wouldn't think that that's necessarily the most prudent course of action out the gate.
There may be some hope, though. I mean, right now, everyone is kind of losing their minds, I think. I mean, I had to explain to a buddy. He's like, well, that what's the sister of battle, like the shrine with all the relics and stuff on it? The Triumph of St. Catherine.
Yep, St. Catherine, yep.
He's like, that's going to be shot off the table because it has too many wounds. You know, it's like, well, what about actual line of sight blocking terrain? He's like, what are you talking about? Like, have you... You do know that you could actually still have line of sight blocking terrain.
Yeah, that model is, while it's kind of broad, it's not that tall from what I've seen. So yeah, you legitimately just hide it.
You could actually have line of sight blocking terrain. Now, we already know that some of the stuff is going to be, you know, a piece of felt with a 5-inch flagpole. Like,
yeah.
But, you know, still, as this edition evolves and people start to play around with more terrain, and people have line of sight blocking terrain right now. Like, all those L's and things on people's tables, they're solid pieces of foam. They block line of sight. Like, we're going to adapt the terrain to make it interactive and enjoyable experience. And
just like we did this edition. Like, the terrain was non-functional. It made for a non-fun experience. At the start of the edition, either you took so many wounds your opponent didn't have a chance of killing it, or you took so many guns that you just won in two turns, e.g. Fire Raptors and Gilliman. Like, we saw that at the start, and it won most of the things it went to, because if it went first, you lost, because we didn't have enough terrain to make the game viable.
Yeah, so, you know, worry not about that kind of stuff. I mean, there will be some things like knights. You know, you're going to have trouble hiding them, and I don't know what the stage of them is, except the fact that we've got this reserve mechanic, and you know that plays into making assault viable. You've got to, if you're going to play assault, I think you have to put forward such a threat, like you were talking about last time with moving or three big units of orcs around, and then potentially things that, because Alpha Lake organically. I'm sorry, I'm not trying to use the old antiquated term from three editions ago. Outflank is the term that one may use to talk about units coming in from anywhere, you know, on the table edges or backside of the board or something like that.
Mm. Another thing I think, and this is where we come back to the Outriders, you're going to want to look for multi-purpose units rather than single-purpose units. And I think that only, while that detracts from some armies, you know, namely things like, I guess, demons, because apart from horrors, there isn't a single troop choice you can take that has a ranged weapon. And I think it's going to lead into a very interesting bit of thing. I think, like I said, Outriders are very well placed to get a lot out of this edition because you want fast-moving, multi-purpose things. You want things that can do more than one thing. You don't want a thing that has to get in combat to get its value. You know what I mean? You want something that's going to be able to extract some value on the table if it doesn't get to do its modus operandi. You know, it has a second purpose. And I like that kind of thinking. I like that kind of playing. Because that builds into what Red said before, that kind of all comers style of playing the game. And so, yeah, things like intercessors are going to seem really potent because they're both good at holding objectives and keeping them, but they also have relevant melee and relevant firepower. Same goes for these Outriders. I do think it's a bit of a shame that it seems like Marines are going to benefit from this the best because they have a lot of really good multi-purpose units, but and good rules and good armor. I mean, the proof will be in the points. I like saying that instead of the pudding. That's my little saying at the moment. The proof will be in the points. Yeah, I find that a little bit interesting. But yeah, a lot of armies can do it. Like surprisingly, GSC can make a surprisingly versatile, non-entirely melee-based army. If you need examples of that, look at the list Eric Lathuris brought to CanCon this year. He lost one game by 1 point to the overall winner, and he was running a shooting GSC list, a shooting horde GSC list. I'm not saying that's the best way to go now, but I'm just saying that's a thing. It exists. It's doable. So yeah, it's not all doom and gloom.
Well, I mean, that's pretty Gene Sealer culture right now, based on the way everything's worded, could technically appear on the bottom level and in engagement range of a unit on the second level, 5 inches above them.
Isn't that interesting?
I mean, they're 3 inches away. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that's going to stay that way. I'm just saying that, you know, that's another way, if you are keen on assault, that is kind of one way you can help control the battlefield or maybe dictate how someone deploys. And that's where I'm going is that, like, I think you've got to structure your army that makes your opponent make some difficult choices and maybe change how they're used to playing.
That's the whole thing, right? That's the definition of maneuvering is actually conducting movement to gain positional advantage in order to appropriately, offensively influence your enemy. And so, like, you're absolutely right. That's absolutely what it should be about. It shouldn't be a game where you can just sit back and, I mean, we know there are armies like that, and that's okay. That's also a technique. But like you said, Paul, you should be wanting to force your opponent into a dilemma. And what an amazing tactical thing to do it through actual maneuver.
Well, people are talking about the desperate breakout, but that still can attempt to do a fallback maneuver. But if you have a way of denying a fallback, you know, either through Drukhari or Slaaneshi demons, I feel like there's some other ways too.
Night Lords have got a way as well. There's actually surprisingly quite a few out there.
Yeah, I mean, so they get to attempt the fallback, but if they can't make a fallback period, then they can't desperate breakout either.
Mm.
And these abilities, I think, are seen as superfluous. You know, I mean, I don't know if that's the right word. They just don't get taken very often. But now there may be even more incentive to take them, and one way to build into your assault theme list.
That's because a savvy player can get the benefits of those things without having to. A savvy player who's like has got their skills in wrapping and trapping and tri-pointing down pat. They don't need those things. They can tri-point almost at will with correct maneuvering, as Red said, and good placement and good, you know, knowledge of the game. But when tri-pointing isn't as big a deal and you want to be able to use that unit of, like, let's for the sake of it say 30 demonettes to tap four things. You can't necessarily wrap four things, but you can definitely tap four things. And then you've got the mirror. What's the name of the mirror?
Contorted Epitome.
Yeah, sitting behind them. And that's a game winner. That's an absolute game winner.
A random Fiend of Slaanesh.
Yeah, a single Fiend of Slaanesh, which is so underutilized, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Love those dudes, especially the new models.
It's a great point. And even, like, we've talked a lot about how the assault phase, and we'll actually talk about a way to stymie someone's charge with the Adeptus Mechanicus coming up soon. But the Fire Overwatch being moved to a stratagem, it will ensure some amount of extra bodies are actually there to get into combat.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, a lot of the time I know, like, I don't want to come back to Space Marines, but charging Space Marines was always a scary prospect. Because even like 10-man intercessors, the Iron Hands intercessors or whatever, they've got, especially Iron Hands when they Overwatch better and whatnot. You're like, I could lose one dude, I could lose five guys. Like, this could be really, really bad. And it's against Iron Hands. They're taking the board away and it's really hard for me to get them back. So just to need to contend with them. But you always, against armies like that, you always felt like you were at a double disadvantage. You felt like you had to charge them, but you felt like you were going to be punished if you did or if you didn't.
Oh, well, I feel like you were charging a unit of Dark Reapers from 9 inches away. You don't want to be in that situation. How many, on average, do you think Berserkers over the course of a game would you lose to Overwatch? I mean, I know it all adds, I mean, maybe onesie-twosie here and there, but it all adds up, right?
It absolutely does add up. But I mean, to the next point, you know, Overwatch is going to be limited, right? To a certain extent, except for Tau, because they just get to Overwatch for free, but everybody else has to pay CP to do it. But the next part being that, so like, you know, we were kind of talking about it, and Adam mentioned getting into it, getting there. I had to factor, and this is actually a real world thing in regards of conducting the offense. So we have ratios, right? Like when we go into an attack, the basic, like most common ratio that you see taught at the fundamental level is a 3-to-1 ratio, because you just understand you're going to lose, you're going to absolutely lose something in the attack. And that's been a historical precedent. And so I was playing World Eaters, so I could have had more Berserkers as troops if I wanted. But, you know, the average other Space Marine player, that if they're not troops, you only get 3 of them. But so you figure you're going to lose some. But I also had Rhinos. I had Dreadclaws to help me get there. I also had Lords of Discordant and Demon Princes. And I had all of these things. I had to overwhelm my opponent in the melee capacity just to make sure that I got something in there to actually do something. And I don't think that element is going away, especially as we talk about locking things down and whatnot. I think that massing on the field, whether it's hordes or you can just get MSU or elite units up the field, by being able to overwhelm your opponent, however you can do that. I mean, you know, Chaos Knights or Knights or I mean, there's tons of units that can move quickly, but being able to get out there and do that and overwhelm the opponent and take up board space is definitely, that all plays into the offense. And you have to have mass. I think that's going to be kind of a hard deal if you go in there with some of like one-off units, especially with the escape routes offered going into 9th edition.
Now, I think you want to be charging either with just a fat 20 plus 30 plus unit from a couple inches away. But see, I guess, the only time I'm charging from more than 7 inches away is when I'm deep striking and I'm coming in from some alternative deployment method. If I'm ever orchestrating a charge outside of that situation, I don't think I'm really ever charging that often from more than 2 or 3 inches away.
And that's fair. I think in a lot of cases that, especially for, say, like Space Marine players, I totally think that that's something that they can do, because they can get up the field, whether you're using impulsors or you come in, they have a degree of durability that they can actually make those distances. In a lot of cases, I found myself, and this isn't as much of an issue when you consider the board has shrunk, but in 8th edition, I needed about a turn to get up the field and position myself appropriately. And I tried to make my position as difficult as possible for my opponent, so they couldn't just shoot everything I had off the field. Some were definitely able to do that, but I would position myself so that I could, you know, like you said, get up into that closer range. But I know, so again, the big difference folks talking about between to 8th and 9th, and this is just a point of transition. I don't think that it necessarily debilitates offense, melee offense by any means, but I would definitely charge everything within 12 inches. And I know we kind of talked about this last time, but you can't do that anymore. So yeah, you got to be sure that you're going to have to build in some other redundancies to make up for that. And, you know, World Eaters, for example, there's a Warlord trait that's +1 to charge. It's also to advance. If you're taking Icons of Khorne for all of those Berserkers, all of them can reroll to charge. I mean, there's just things that you have to factor in to make up for it. And I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. It's just it's almost to a certain extent keeping people honest in regards of their effort towards ensuring melee occurs.
I think it's going to change what, like the amount of things that you threats you try to engage at one time, but you'll also hopefully have more units. Like you'll make contact with the enemy with at least two or three, or you'll be in threat range with at least two or three units, whereas as opposed before you only needed one.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of nuance that's going to occur now. A lot of different nuance. I mean I guess the scope of the old fight phase and assault phase was really only limited by your ambition. Like you could double fight, triple fight in some occasions, reach out, touch this, tap this, wrap this, do whatever you want. I think now it's going to be a lot more about making sure that the resources you do have, your either couple of key melee units, get a lot of value. Like, e.g., your smash captain must get X value from him. He must produce this for you on the tabletop to be worthy of retaining his space. Because you could just replace that guy with a buffing character at your leisure.
Yeah, that's fair. We're going to have to see how lists play out. Like, what is the actual real threat? Like, I don't think Assault is dead. I think some of these other abilities are going to bubble up to be a lot more useful.
Yeah,
I think we'll see more rhinos, although I've been like a proponent of the troop transport for a few months now.
I can tell you, super strong. I dusted off my chimeras yesterday. And I'm thinking about ripping off those multi lasers I've had on there since 6th edition and getting some heavy bolters or heavy flamers on the turrets. Yeah. Either. I'm sure I could get away with just having the heavy bolters and saying the heavy flamers, like on the odd occasion I feel like doing it. But the fact is I don't think I have the heavy flamers anymore. I think I cannibalized those or traded them out for other bits and pieces. So I think in heavy bolters it is.
Are you thinking that's better than the multi-laser? I mean, the strength 6?
Yeah, I think I do. I think the rend 1 makes it better, makes it more multi-purpose than the strength 6. I mean, just straight up asking you, like, what stuff is strength 6 better against than strength 5-1? There's not much.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
In reality, like, toughness 7 is the tank toughness. There's very few things that people take en masse that is toughness 6. I know, Torox is one of them, but when was the last time you saw a Torox? Maybe you'll see him now. But I mean, I think Night Spinner is a toughness 6. When was the last time you got to shoot at a Night Spinner? You either punch it or you ignore it. And I think the strength 6 is kind of this wonky, doesn't really do much strength.
Night Spinners are on a Wave Serpent chassis. I mean, they had to be 7, don't they?
No, I was pretty sure they were 6. I might be wrong.
We have a way to check, but I'm not going to right now.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they're 6 for some reason. Never mind. I might be completely tripping. Yes, and other things like a strength 6, let's say like a Storm Raven. There isn't a Storm Raven strength. No, Storm Raven's not even toughness 6. See, nothing's even toughness 6, guys. I'm
Sentinels?
Trying to think of things that are toughness.
Sentinels
6.
Maybe 5.
Yeah, Sentinels probably. Are.
Cool. Let me know when they become good.
The Iron Striders, I believe.
I have 9. Six. I have 9 Sentinels, by the way. And so there's another thing. Like armored Sentinels, if they stay around the same points cost as they are now, because they are real cheap for their toughness and amount of wounds and save, I could see myself using them because they got a couple of cool strats. Like they got
weapon
the strat for half damage.
Actually, pretty functional. Yeah. Pretty. No, you're not wrong.
I think there's some exciting things there.
Yeah, especially being able to shoot into combat.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's what would happen. They'd get tapped and you're like, oh, wow, these guys are worse than guardsmen in combat.
Yeah, for a while they evaporated nice? Because people would, I mean, to the same point we're making, you would forward deploy them and people would basically use them to catapult themselves into your line. So, you know, unless you were doing the trick where you tried to overcharge the plasma cannon and destroy them so their charge would fail.
I've done that.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of cool when you accidentally have that happen. Yeah, like holy crap! Yeah. This is now something to do. You know, unless you were doing that, they bear extreme liability because these units that were relying off the double, triple move, double fight just for the movement mechanic to go up and tap or to touch your stuff. You know, that's why they disappeared. But I mean, I don't know that they're not good anymore. Or they're not good anymore. I don't know what I'm trying to say. You might want to take a Sentinel is what I'm trying to say.
You might want to take a Sentinel. Yeah. Yeah, so I'm really excited for like a mechanized way to play the game again because I loved that. That was what I did all through 7th edition. I played mono guard and it was good. It was bad. It was mostly terrible, but I loved it. I just loved it. It was just how I enjoyed playing the game. And I'm hoping I can get back to that.
So I see right now in my mind's eye people, when they're first 9th edition games, is they have these tanks, and these tanks are surrounded by half domes, three-quarter domes of troops that are, you know, a couple inches out to where you can't declare a charge on the tank. So they're buying their tank an extra turn. And, you know, where I'm going with this, that's what I see. I see that being an easy strategy to think, just conceptualize. I can do this, and I'm going to get two turns of unfettered firing out of my cool stuff
that
I get to play with now. And then when they touch me, I still get to fire. It's going to be great. I'm going to love these tanks. It's going to be amazing. So, but that's the challenge to overcome if you're playing an assault armor. You've got to figure out a way to crack that nut.
Agreed. Now, so coming back to the multi-purpose thing I was talking about, people, I had a conversation with some, I recorded a podcast and had a conversation with some very good friends, very top-level players. Like, one was Matt Morisoli, who won the ITC in Australia. He got that the all-expenses-paid trip to the LBO this year. And I was talking to him, and he played the Plague Bearer horde. You know, he had the bombs in reserve, the Zangors or the Horrors or the Bloodletters, and then he had all the T-Suns characters behind the demon screens. And he was of the opinion that there's no reason to ever fight twice anymore. Because in his mind, the fight twice stratagem wasn't for killing things. It was for trapping and holding things, getting more board control, getting more space and more distance. I'm of the opinion that fight twice is now exactly what it says on the box now. Fight twice is when you can't kill a thing by fighting it once. When you've got an intercessor with a power fist and someone's just driven, like, I've just driven a chimera through full of obsec guys into that, onto that objective. You got to clear them off and then be able to kill the guys inside ASAP, or else you're going to start losing points.
Oh, that guy with the power fist. Think of this champion moment where someone heroically intervenes in your squad and they kill everybody but the champion. He swings, he does four wounds to that 5-1 character, and you just got to close him out.
Yeah, stuff like that. Like, I feel like that's what the fight twice is now. It's not for gaining distance and janky exploits, or, well, sorry, not exploits, or janky things to mix up the board state. It's for actually killing things. It's, you got to fight twice to kill things, not to trap things or get deeper into your opponent's lines or get on objectives and stuff. It's just, okay, yeah, that thing's out of, you know, that's not going to die if I fight it twice. Guess I better fight it twice. Sorry, you know what I mean? Not going to die if I fight it once.
No, I mean, and so that's actually, there's what you just stated is, Adam, is there's a lot to that in regards of how, you know, what is victory and how do you achieve it? And, you know, there's actually a really big debate behind that in regards. And I'm tying this into the game because it totally depends, in my opinion, on your objectives. We're still pending exactly what that means, but it could be that you need to gain the distance, that you need to get further, or you need to get closer to contest something. I do agree that a lot of it has to do with destroying things, right? I do think that one way of definitely ensuring victory is by defeating and removing your opponent from the field. And so it's just I think there's a give and take between your position versus the decimation of your enemy in regards of, you know, do you need to get this much further in? Do you need to do this? So, like, you know, we were saying earlier when I was talking about berserkers, I mean, you're talking about, it's been quite a minute since I've run like hordes of berserkers, where I'm talking like 60 berserkers, and that's just three squads. But when you're talking about just 8-man squads of berserkers, you are definitely concerned and understanding that units are going to get out of it. But even with 8 guys or 6 guys, you know, like Paul mentioned, I'm going to lose stuff to attrition. So I just accept that I have a squad with 3 or 4 things. And this definitely goes to your point in that if I went from 8 guys with 41 dice to 4 guys of 21 dice, yeah, those berserkers specifically are going to fight twice anyways. But if I really want to make sure I get that extra oomph out of them, I'm definitely going to have them fight again to get that out of it. But with just those few guys, I'm also going to be concerned about their position. And so you can't, for some folks out there in getting the, I was talking about earlier about massing effects and what you can achieve. And to a point, your presence on the board is one thing, but you definitely fighting again is absolutely a iteration of mass and increasing that mass. And so, just reinforcing what you're saying.
Yeah, another way of thinking about it is people are saying that 30-man units are dead. They get so many downsides and all these other things. Hordes aren't there. Well, so here's a different way of thinking about it. You take 30 guys, you take 30 orc boys, and you know only 10 to 12 of them are going to make it to where they need to be. But it's okay, because fighting twice, 10 or 12 of them still do the exact amount, same amount of realistic and viable damage that the 30 of them were going to do. So it's kind of the same difference, and it comes out in the wash when you want to think about it in those terms. Like the fight again, or the strategies you'd put into that 30-man, it might not be Orc Boys, it could be anything. It could be Bloodletters or Zangors or whatever, that Gene Stealers. If you can use synergy and strategies and stratagems to get the same amount of efficiency out of that unit when it's at half strength, when you make combat, it's still effectively at full strength, you know? Mm-hmm. If you can use other resources to make it just as relevant or more relevant than it was before.
When you're fighting with the champion twice.
And because you've got a smaller footprint, you can be a lot more places, you can do a lot more things. So as much as this is a downside, there's still ways to get the same effectiveness if you're just willing to pivot your thinking somewhat.
Yeah, I'm with you. No, I think it's going to be harder. It is definitely going to be the tactics are going to change how you do it, but your army composition is what's going to change, and I think that's going to enable you to do some similar things and still get that feel from the game. Now, I don't know what the solution is to what I'm talking about, though, those half moons that are surrounding the tanks. You know, but maybe jump pack stuff. I mean, I know, you know, I'm a jump pack fan.
Yeah.
By nature.
Just a little.
But being able to ignore some of those, what will turn into maybe sloppy or low point screens that are just centered on preventing you from having linear movement towards their things.
Well, and again, to the point of hordes, right? Only one thing can do the desperate breakout stratagem. If you lock in multiple squads, multiple units, only one of those is going to run away. You can still technically tri-point the other. There's nothing, you know, that is a benefit of having the numbers to be able to accomplish that.
100%. Well, and on top of that, I think tri-pointing can possibly have this almost negative effect. I mean, this is a complete shift of thinking now. I'm doing my best to try and to not, like I did with 7th to 8th edition. Like, a lot of people struggle to divest themselves from what 7th edition was and absorb what 8th edition is. I'm trying to come in with that mindset of just saying, hey, 8th is gone. Do not compare 9th to 8th. Like, do your best to diverge from the things that you knew and just absorb things as they are now. And if I do that, I don't see the loss of tri-pointing as this big, erroneous, awesome, or horrible thing. I'm seeing this as a way for me to exploit my opponent's CP pool and drain them, make them pay a tax point every turn to continue to stay in the game and not being wrapped and trapped. I'm going to be looking at this to be like, okay, well, you've got an army that needs CP, needs X amount of CP. So if I force you to use Desperate Breakout twice during the first two or three turns of the game, that's going to deplete you X turns later when you need to be using this to get your most of your damage output.
Even with getting a CP back every turn, that's still a pretty healthy burn rate compared to what you are burning.
And at the same time, you can exploit that in other ways using things like Calidus Assassins. Like, if two turns of Reign of Confusion plus two turns of having to use Desperate Breakout, that's all of a sudden most a lot more likely than not to be 5 CP instead of 4 CP you cost your opponent. And things like that can really, I think, you know, I don't want to go out on a limb and say it's game changing, but that's how I'm trying to start to think of it. Like, and I think there's merit there. I think there is play to that style, and just using the Desperate Breakout thing, or sorry, forcing your opponent to use the Desperate Breakout and seeing as that you implying a penalty upon them to continue playing the game the way they would like to.
Well, I mean, you're forcing them to decide whether or not they want to use Overwatch. So that you're talking about burning 5 CP, but what they've realistically done is probably burn 7.
Yeah, exactly right. And then, you know, there's all other things. Like, if I'm a guardsman and then you're charging a tank and I want to use Gunnery Experts, there's another CP there. Is it Ultramarines that get a CP for, and then they can essentially use for the greater good? They can Overwatch for each other. There's some more CP there. Like, there's a lot of ways in which you can kind of use these kind of things, these deterrents that players have. And I'm going to go on a limb. I think we're going to be a bit Pavlov dogged at the start of this.
Here we go again.
Into feeling like tri-pointing is the game-breaking, game-losing, game-winning thing it was in 8th edition. And so people are going to want to be real trigger-happy on those 2 CP, I feel. That's not based on anything. That's more based on, like, how I feel about it.
I think what you're pointing out is, like, exploiting the perception of abundance, and then they quickly find out by turn 2 or 3 that they're down to 3 CP
and one of them
to lend their lines.
Yeah, yeah, really, I like well it. Said that. The perception of abundance. That's really good.
That plays right into what I was talking about in regards of mass, right? So we've got these things, these fundamentals of the offense. And melee is a very much offensive concept. And so we tie that into concentration. Another one is audacity. And so you can't hold back in a lot of cases. I mean, there is something. So the another one is tempo. And so you really need to be able to control. And so that's where, you know, someone, a friend of mine, we were discussing, they were looking at Space Marines and they were like, okay, so Blood Angels or White Scars? Like they definitely want to try and play into some of the melee capabilities of it. And so when you look at it, I mean, there's a pretty good debate between the two of them because they both have a lot going for them when it comes to supplementing and reinforcing the melee. And Blood Angels have that up front. They've got the bonuses, you know, to wound, the extra charge, the AP. White Scars, both White Scars and Blood Angels definitely kick it into another gear when they get to the Assault Doctrine. But that still takes some time to get there. And so you've really got to be able to control it, kind of like what you were saying in regards to the balanced approach. And I mentioned even with my berserkers and whatnot, having the delivery method. How exactly are they getting there? And how are you, the player, able to help control that tempo and manage the battlefield in regards of, well, I want to attack them at this point so that I can get this much mass and concentration, going back, you know, into what you guys are talking about, and the idea of presenting to your opponent an overwhelming amount of dilemmas that they really just can't. They're kind of on the back foot as you seize that moment with audacity and you take over the field. And that's really, I mean, that's really it right there, right? That's the tactica right there.
And what you're talking, that's a real life philosophy of combat, isn't it? Audacity.
Theory. Yep. Yeah. That's real theory of war stuff right there. Yes.
And but that's so applicable to what we do here, like especially what you're saying about mash and pressure. Well, I think those are the two of the biggest keystone building blocks of what the last edition was, like mass and pressure. Even like the way you played the game, the way you just told us you would play the game. Mass and pressure. I love it. And audacity. Like what's more audacious than a berserkers in a rhino and mass, you know?
Yeah, because like Paul brought it, I mean, you're going to get shot at. You're going to lose stuff. You just have to accept it and you have to keep. I mean, it was something I kind of enjoyed talking about with the other person when I went up to the table. I'd say, hey, look, I'm a level 4 NPC. I'm literally just going to charge at you. I'm just going to run at you. All you got to do is just, yep, you know exactly what's going to happen. Just shoot me and you'll be fine. It'll be okay.
Look, Mauler Fiends so and Skull Cannons of Corn.
Hey man,
they're coming back.
They are. I mean, think about it. Defilers, right? Vehicles, these big old monstrous things that can touch a lot of stuff and get around. I mean, Mauler Fiends, Defilers, Blood Slaughterers, Venom Crawlers, and I mean, Skull Cannons too with their blast weapon. Like, it's awesome.
I'm genuinely excited to see if Defilers can be not a joke.
Like I don't want to go too crazy. I know we talked about them before, but I mean this is the what I really want to do is just challenge people's list ideas. Is like, yeah, I think it would be a little bit of an error to assume that your list will just translate 100% into ninth.
And so right.
Things absolutely won't work the exact same way that they did, but that's really by design. The quicker we can move to that next evolution of list design and figuring out what special rules mean the most, we'll all be better off, I think.
I agree
with that, absolutely.
And let's talk about, I know we've delayed talking about like Engine War and War of the Spider and that kind of stuff, but a couple of listeners have submitted some, what I think are going to be some fundamentally like earth-shaking stratagems that I want to talk about.
Yeah.
I know just talked about ways to like make charge and assaults work, and I'm going to talk about ways, one of the ways to really completely stymie that. So Nick sent something into our Facebook page, and this is the stratagem for the Cerberus Raiders. They have a 2CP strat. Let me get the exact name of it. The Tactica Obliqua. Use this stratagem in your opponent's charge phase. When a Cerberus Raiders unit from your army is chosen as the target of a charge for the first time that turn, instead of firing Overwatch, that unit can move or fall back as if it were your movement phase. It cannot advance as part of this move. Now, that looks like a fairly vanilla stratagem in 7th.
Mm.
I'm sorry, yep. In 8th.
In 8th, yeah.
But in 9th?
I think it's really powerful.
Yeah, really, if any powerful part of the charge fails, the entire charge fails.
Yeah. And if you notice, I think I pointed this out off air, that it's very open-ended. It's so open-ended in the fact that I think if you paid 2 CP and you were tri-pointed, you could also use Desperate Breakout at the same time. So your opponent could think they've got the safest charge in the world, the safest possible charge you could possibly have. Something is tri-pointed, it's trapped, there's no safer charge. And then, nah, bro, I'm gone.
Like, I think you would have to be able to fire Overwatch, because it says instead of firing Overwatch, the unit can make a fallback move.
Oh, okay. So you'd have to be at some point eligible for Overwatch. Yeah, no, that's a way of saying it, for sure.
I think so. I mean, that's the way I would rule it.
Yep, no, that's fair. Otherwise, good God.
These guys have a 12-inch move. So if you're
moving
7 inches, 3 inches away or whatever, your charge could become impossible.
Well, yeah, literally impossible.
I think you could declare it, you know, this, put it on the fact watch, I guess, but because they, you know, you would declare your charge, then they would activate this, and then they can move outside of 12 from you, but you'd still would have been able to declare it. So, but you're not making that charge. I mean, I guess technically, like Howling Banshees or something, to get +3 to charge.
Yeah, there are some things that can charge outside of 12 inches. There's only a handful, though.
I am not suggesting taking Howling Banshees, by the way. This is not an endorsement of Howling Banshees. I may eat those words, but...
there are ways to work around this, though. Like, there are workarounds to this. You just charge them with a jump unit first before you expose your meat and potatoes unit. Like, if you have you got your Sanguard lined up, but they're out of line of sight and they're in a safe position, you charge them with your scout unit.
Yeah, or a support character, or a lieutenant, or so, you know, the Dark Apostle. You've got him up there, and you know he could survive Overwatch if necessary. And
exactly right, you can bait this out and make him burn it. And you know, if you plan it well enough, you can not expose yourself in the same time. You can still remain relatively safe. I think it's a very powerful stratagem for what is, I think, possibly one of the most powerful factions going into 9th edition. So yeah, everyone, watch out for AdMech. I'm scared. You should be too.
Yeah, a whole raft of new stratagems and new units, and they're going to be a powerhouse. And I think this stratagem, again, it's 2 CP, but it's what it is. It's a better than option than firing Overwatch, and I think it's more than 100% more valuable than that. So it's worth the CP.
And it frees up your Overwatch stratagem for something more meaningful if you need it.
Your Cataphrons or your Castellan Robots.
Castellan Robots, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is an absolute one to watch. And if you're playing somebody that has these units in their army, they're going to be out in front and they're going to do this to you. And you.
I hope they tell you about it, because, oh, good Lord, is that a gotcha and a half? They pull that on you. Oh.
Well, and that's something, right? So AdMech, I mean, they already had enough units in their front line that... again, being a melee army, something I was concerned about. If you saw a large unit of Dragoons, I was concerned about that, right? Because they could kick back so much that, you know, between how many wounds they had and whatnot. And now you're telling me on top of that, AdMech also have these hounds that can essentially completely nullify my melee capability if that's their front screen. Like, that's just such a good front screen unit in regards to... if you're applying it against someone who's trying to charge you.
Yeah, it's a fantastic little tandem that they can do with these layers. At the same time, like, those Dragoons, like, that you can do a very relevant, very nice mid-range all-comers army for AdMech, which is why I think they're so powerful, because they can do... I think I'm talking about AdMech so much because melee-wise, I think their counter-assault units are stupendously good.
Priests, Iron Striders...
Yeah, Dragoons, Iron Striders, Priests, like even robots with fists or breaches in a pinch, Cataphron breaches, can be used to really good effect in the right hands. I mean, I used to use I think it's two tournaments I went to. I even went to a tournament in the States while I was over here in Aberdeen, Washington, with some very good, very wonderful people. I think it was a Weird Bird Gaming ran an event, and I came second in that GT, by the way. Hell yeah. But there I was running a single unit of, I think, 11 breaches, and I was using Stygies to just clog up the board with them turn one. Like, I would move advance them turn one and just get them right in the most annoying position I could find.
Yeah. Okay, and let's not forget about also the electrofilament countermeasures. That's the one that turns off. That's the Archaeoraptor that turns off auras. I mean, I know we talked about that kind of stuff, but, you know, the new Marines, the people are going to be using them there. Their characters have some pretty impressive auras, especially that. What's his name? Judicar.
Yeah, Judicar. Well, that's right.
Absolutely. They're so... I love this stratagem. I love that they've got this. It's such a game changer. used at the right time. I was thinking about like even litanies and stuff like that. Astaroth. How many buffs does Astaroth and Lamardis and the guys of those ilk give out?
A couple.
A bunch. It's like it's more than one, probably less than five, but somewhere in the middle. And like even Gilliman, like you said this before, Paul, off air, like turning off like Gilliman. I mean, how much efficiency does Gilliman add to a melee unit? Or to a non-melee unit. He turns a non-melee unit, something that's like a 50-50 in the middle, like a veteran intercessors with a Thunderhammer, he turns them into absolute like blenders. Turning him off brings them back to mortal standpoints. You know?
That's a great segue into talking about the Custodes. Like the other powerhouse stratagem they got sent in is from the War of the Spider, and it's called the Emperor's Auspice. Listen to this quote. When the eye of the emperor is upon his champions, no foul trickery of the foe can prevail.
Mm.
And that foe is Gilliman in this case.
Yes. So I jumped the gun there a little bit. I thought we'd mentioned that one already.
No. It's okay. Let me say use this stratagem in any phase. When an Adeptus Custodes unit from your army is chosen as the target of an attack, until the end of that phase, when resolving an attack against the unit, your opponent cannot reroll any dice for that attack. Mm. Buddy Vinny, who sent this in, he said he just picked apart a Marine army just on the back of this stratagem.
It's any phase. Any phase.
Yeah.
Any
no,
phase.
No rerolls against these guys that are already pretty stout.
I'll say that again. Any phase.
That's awesome.
It's 2 CP. But that was a bit of a problem for Custodes before. It is no longer a problem.
So here's an idea. So you can't reroll the dice yet. It says you can't reroll the dice.
Your opponent cannot reroll any dice for that attack.
So just putting it off of that attack. Yes, of course. Yes. All right.
Yeah, and it's until the end of the phase when resolving an attack against that unit, your opponent can't reroll any dice.
Well, obviously, the best use of this is the shooting phase. Because obviously, like, I mean, I'm not going to say it's not great in the assault phase either, but Custodes are already great in the assault phase, you know? Mm-hmm. They don't need the help there. They need the help not getting shot to death before they make it to the shooting phase. So the assault phase. But
Well, really this is one of those stratagems that it has a macro effect. Like you get to burn it, and then anything that it gets benefit of, not just one unit or one attack that gets solved or tries to resolve, it's anything. And then you pointed this out when we were talking about this in the pre-show. You know, they're next to your Vexilla. You get some benefits from terrain, you know, the new terrain rules. You've really insulated that unit.
Absolutely. And I'm just going to say something now. Alaris Terminators, they are so hot right now. If you have some, put them on the table, give them the -2 rend with a Vexilla. And then, you know, if you come down and you fail your charge for whatever reason, or you butcher whatever you charge, and you're in their lines and they try and take you out. Nah, bro, no rerolls for you, plus a -1 to hit, and I'm in cover maybe, and yeah, really, really saucy.
You got Aramite and Adamantium, even if they're not in cover, that's a stratagem that when resolving an attack against an Adeptus Custodes Terminator unit, armor penetration characteristics of -1 or -2 is resolved to 0 for that attack.
So incredibly strong against
that's
Marines. I can't overstate how good that is against Doctrines and against the things that would be the stuff that mulches through your Custodes. Like, because a regular bolt rifles, yeah, when they get into tactical draw for 2 turns, they get rend 2, and you're like, nah, still got 2+ save. You know, all those suppressors, yeah, so many things. The suppressors when they're not in heavy doctrine, Thunderfire is still getting a 2+. It's just really good, really good.
Yeah, I mean, take you know, Vinny, right, for example, his stuff he's been talking to me about in regards of taking, just like you mentioned, the Alaris Custodes, and then breaking them up using the stratagem that turns them all into independent characters. My goodness.
Unleash, like, the lions. How cool. Yeah. How cool. Chaos. How cool a name is that?
Pure chaos. It's just awesome. I think it's a great idea.
I mean, I know people have been talking about they think the Custodes are going to get a big benefit, but I think that on the back of War of the Spider and like everything that's moving into ninth, they can shoot. They've got a decent amount of anti-screen either because of, you know, some of their mass shots, bolter fire, other tanks and stuff, Forge World stuff. The Dreadnoughts, I mean, they got a lot going for them.
Well, consider this, we know how important holding objectives are throughout turns, Custodes can sit and hold a place better than most. Maybe not as best as the best things like Iron Hands and of that ilk, but better than most. Let's say you get to take like 2 4-man Alaris units. Turn 2, you deep strike 1 down onto an objective you've cleared, and then next turn you split them. the amount of thought calculation and target priority and the nuance and brain math people have to go through to kill those four individual OBSEC models that have a 2+4+4 wounds, that amount of mental arithmetic is insane.
Well, if think about bringing down a fat unit and then just burning 3 CP on them with Auspice and R-Ride Nanomanium.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then next turn you split them.
And then they're scoring 65 points. The new scoring mechanism is just with you deciding to sit them in one place and spend some CP.
I just want to say well done to G-Dub, like turning Custodes around. I'm sure we're going to talk about Death Guard at some point as well, because holy, they get a lot out of Psychic Awakening. But Custodes feel so reinvigorated. They seemed like a very stale, didn't do anything special army before. Like, they didn't feel particularly killy in combat. They didn't feel particularly resilient as they should. They didn't feel imposing or dominating. But with the, like, starting with 12 CP, holy crap. And then all these new Psychic Awakening buffs and tricks and stuff, holy crap, they feel incredible.
Yeah, you took them to get the bare minimum, whatever you needed to get the Caladius investment for that. Basically the thing that shot Gilliman Power Fist across the table. You know, that's all the
Telemons when they were the thing, all the bikes when they were the thing. Like, it's just your different flavor of SKU list. I'm hoping the proof will be in the points, but if they stay, you know, around the same feel as they are now, but just get like 20-30% smaller, I think you can expect big things from them.
Yeah, I think they're going to scratch a lot of itches for winning 9th edition games.
Unfortunately, I don't like that you have to lean on Forge World to get like long range fire support. Apart from a Land Raider, and sorry, it's a Land Raider. They haven't been good for a while now. Maybe not. Maybe 9th is different.
Need the long range support. I think that you're going to be able to selectively beam them in certain places, or have enough durability to actually last to make it there.
Mm. Well, I'm always of the opinion that if a faction can't maintain a position in like a strong position in a meta unless you can make a well-rounded force. And that's a reason why Custodes didn't find their place until the Caladius started becoming strong. But even when it did, the Caladius was so much stronger than everything else in the book, the army was just your Caladiuses. Yeah. Maybe some Palace Grav tanks or whatever. But so I do like the feeling of a well-rounded army. This is why I keep going on about Marines and Admech and Sisters, because they just feel like well-fleshed out, well-rounded armies that are maneuverable and malleable depending on the meta and the mission and what you expect to face. Custodes might come into problems later in the game, because they don't have that long-range fire support, because if people are able to roadblock them, slow them down, slow their advances, zone out their deep strikes, they might come into issues. But I don't think they've ever been in a better position than they are going into 9th. Oh, sorry, a more exciting position going into 9th, because the old ones they had may be more powerful than where they are in the 9th, but I reckon they were more stale and more boring because it was just spamming one unit, you know? Like, that can only get so exciting for so long.
Yeah, you'll see the Custodes' actual frames on the table, which is...
yeah.
That's nice. I'm excited, man. I mean, that's mostly what I wanted to talk about this week. I know this is going to be a long show, so I appreciate everyone hanging in with us.
That's what we do. When was the last time, like, I mean, we know sometimes we've got like a time limit, and we're like, we don't really have a time limit, do we? We just yak as long as we yak, don't we?
Well, this is going to be a big show. It's going to be basically a double-sized episode once all is said and done. And then we got more stuff coming next week. I mean, this is like part two of our actual 9th edition coverage, and we're going to continue to lead up to give our thoughts about maybe how to prepare your armies as it gets up to release day.
Can't wait.
Thanks a lot for joining me, and we'll see you all next week.
See
you. Thanks for having me. See you then.
Handle the truth.